Good day. Today is Friday, 24th April 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. If, once you've watched this programme, you decide you like what you've heard and you wish to indicate that fact. Now, I'm going to touch briefly on the situation in the Middle East at the start of this programme, and then I will be turning again to the situation in the conflict with Russia, though I'll be looking at some new developments in the Russian economy towards the end of this programme. Let's first, however, discuss the situation in the Middle East. We have a continuation of the unstable equilibrium, as it's been described, in the conflict between the United States and Iran. The Strait of Hormuz remains under the tight control of the Iranian military. The United States continues to go through the motions of enforcing a sea blockade on Iran. I say go through the motions. Every so often, the United States seizes a ship which it says is trading with Iran, but it's clear that a large number of ships managed to get through. I'm a little surprised, to say it frankly, that ship owners are prepared to take the risk of having their ships seized in this way. Perhaps they expect to get their ships back and compensation besides via legal action. Who knows? But anyway, what the US Navy is currently doing does not seem to be deterring trade between Iran and China in particular from continuing to take place. And of course, there is still hovering in the background the possibility that at some point over the next few weeks, the Chinese might start to deploy more naval forces to the Arabian Sea and to the Gulf of Oman. In the meantime, the United States continues its military and naval deployments. There are now reports that the George H.W. Bush, the US aircraft carrier, has circumnavigated or has passed through by the Cape of Good Hope, that it is now somewhere off the East African coast. Some place it in the Indian Ocean. I'm not going to try and speculate on its exact whereabouts. But anyway, it is now approaching its deployment positions. By the way, a number of people have made the point that this particular aircraft carrier seems to have been very, very reluctant to take the shorter route through the Mediterranean and the Suez Canal and the Red Sea. I've seen reports that the George H.W. Bush was one of the carriers that previously tangled with the Houthis and apparently received a certain amount of minor damage as a result of that previous tangle with the Houthis. And it looks as if the captain and the crew of the George H.W. Bush are not keen to come too close to the Houthis again. The other US Navy carrier in this sort of general area, the USS Gerald Ford, however, to the best of my knowledge, is indeed in the northern part of the Red Sea. What exactly it is doing there, whether it is monitoring the Houthis or whether there are still plans for it to engage the Iranians at some future time, I do not know. The best guess I have, however, is that the crew of the Gerald Ford must by now be weary and tired. Anyway, these US naval forces continue to gather with the Abraham Lincoln, which has been in continuous station in this area since before the start of the conflict. The United States has three US Navy carriers in the area, and of course the USS Tripoli, the amphibious carrier with the helicopters, that too is in the area also. And before I made this program, there were reports that the United States is again reviewing military options. The first option, this is according to CNN, being to conduct precision strikes against the Iranians. Well, I thought that had already been done. I don't understand why it's assumed that those precision strikes against the Iranians are going to be any more successful than the previous precision strikes against the Iranians. There have been, incidentally, more reports about the overall condition of the Iranian armed forces. It appears that President Trump's claims about the total destruction of the Iranian Air Force are wrong. According to the latest reports, at least 60% of Iran's fighter jets are still operational. In fact, I've even seen it suggested that the only fighter jets that the US has successfully destroyed are old, derelict carcasses of fighter jets that the Iranians kept on their bases and were using for spare parts. The Iranian Air Force, very short of fighter jets, very short of new fighter jets. It's not received any since it took possession of fighter jets transferred to Iran by Saddam Hussein from Iraq at the beginning of the 1991 war. The Iranians impounded all these aircraft and brought them into service in their own air force. Most of them, to my understanding, are MiG-29s. There are some Sukhoi 24s as well. So these are Soviet-era fighter jets. And the Iranians apparently still fly some F-4 Phantoms from the 1970s delivered to the Shah's Air Force. And I don't know whether there's any of the F-14s that the Shah's also imported from the United States, whether any of those are still in operation at the present time. But anyway, the Air Force still functions. The IRGC's flotilla of speedboats apparently mostly remains intact. Iran still has midget submarines and other naval assets of various types. And I've seen reports that Iran has a stockpile of something like 5,000 naval mines which it can use to seed the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz if the situation calls for it and the circumstance for it arises. So significant naval and air assets still. Obviously, we're not talking about an air force that can rival that of the United States or Israel, or a fleet that is similar or comparable to the US Navy. But then, Iran has never sought those sort of capabilities. It requires or seeks different capabilities, and it still has these, and they remain functional. And as I've discussed in previous programs, the Iranian ballistic cruise missile and drone arsenals, by all accounts, remain very substantial. And indeed, gradually, the numbers appear to be according to Western assessments, they appear to be, well, being revised upwards, if I can put it that way. So given that all of that was unsuccessful before, given that the attempts to destroy the Iranian Air Force, Navy, to deplete Iran of ballistic missiles, to destroy Iran's launchers, all of that was unsuccessful. I'm not really sure at all what precision strikes would be intended to do. The second plan is decapitation strikes against the IRGC, which in the United States, has, and in much of the West, is now regularly referred to as the operative power in Iran. As I've discussed in many places, that narrative that began about a week ago about splits between moderates and hardliners in Iran, well, that narrative is now gaining traction. President Trump has adopted it. He appears to, well, he has persuaded himself of its truth, perhaps not appreciating that it was originally a disinformation exercise put together by his own and allied intelligence agencies, just to say. But anyway, he seems to have adopted this theory, and it's been bought into by all sorts of people. And, well, the IRGC features significantly in a lot of this. It's assumed that they're really now running the show in Iran, that the clerical leadership has in some way been sidelined, and that the civilian authorities are no longer in control of Iran, and the IRGC are assumed to be the hardliners. And the idea is presumably to carry out decapitation strikes against them and to hope, to assume that that will open the way for the moderates. The President of the United States, Donald Trump, has actually given some reason to suggest that he, in particular, rather likes this idea. Because I noticed that he'd retweeted a post by somebody called Thiessen. I'm not sure who this person is. In which this Mr. Thiessen suggested that since the Iranian leadership was divided between moderates who want to do a deal and hardliners who don't, the way to achieve victory in Iran was to kill all the hardliners. As if things were ever that simple. And, well, besides, the brutality of this calculus is frankly astonishing. But I'm going to push back on every part of this. First of all, I don't accept that there is this great division between hardliners and moderates within the Iranian leadership. I think people are making altogether too much of a spat by the Tasnim news agency with the Iranian foreign ministry. They assume that maybe the Tasnim news agency was put up to it by the IRGC, which is not impossible. But, well, that spat is entirely over the poor wording of a statement issued by the foreign ministry following the conclusion of the ceasefire between Israel and Lebanon. A ceasefire which, by the way, has now been extended for a further 3 weeks. And, well, what people are missing is that the criticism of the foreign ministry statement, Araghchi's statement, by Tasnim was entirely a criticism of wording. It did not suggest or imply in any way any division of policy. Anyway, the Iranians have now responded to this narrative that there are divisions between moderates and hardliners. There's been simultaneous statements published by three top Iranian officials, President Pezeshkian, Speaker Ghalibaf, and the head of the judiciary, Gholam Hossein Mohseni Ejay, all of whom have said that there is in fact no division in Iran between hardliners and moderates. Pezeshkian put it like this: in Iran there are no hardliners and moderates. We are all Iranians and revolutionaries with ironclad unity of nation and state and obedience to the leader. We will make the aggressor regret. One God, one nation, one leader, one path, victory for Iran, dearer than life. That's Pezeshkian, and he, of course, is often the person who is referred to here as the moderate, the leader of the moderates. And, of course, the leader he's referring to is Mujtaba Khamenei. There are continuing reports about his very poor health, the fact that he's severely wounded, the fact that he's going in and out of comas, that his life hangs in the balance. I don't know that anyone actually knows whether or not that is actually true. Anyway, the top judge, Mr. Ejay, then spoke out and said that the US president should know that terms like hardliner and moderate are meaningless constructs in Western political discourse. In Iran, our all groups stand united in full alignment with the leader. And though I don't have the wording of a parallel statement made by Speaker Ghalibaf, I understand that it was framed in the same way. In fact, Ejay, Ghalibaf and Pezeshkian were clearly coordinating their comments with each other. Just saying. So I don't myself buy into this idea that there is a division between moderates and hardliners. I've seen no actual evidence at all that this is the case. The Iranians seem to be in agreement about the demands that they're making. All of them, for the moment, are agreed about their 10-point proposal. And, well, it's perhaps worth remembering that the meeting that took place, what's about 10 days ago now, between the Americans and the Iranians, almost 2 weeks ago actually now, in Islamabad, well, it was not that there was a division between moderates and hardliners that persuaded the Iranians to come to the table and to have these discussions with the Americans. It was pressure from China, a fact which has been acknowledged by the United States and reported by Pakistan, which acted as the mediator. It was pressure by China that persuaded the Iranians, all of whom had doubts, to come to the meeting and to meet with the Americans in Islamabad. As to the IRGC, well, it is different from the rest of the Iranian armed forces in that the Iranian military is based on conscription, whereas the IRGC is based on voluntary recruitment. So it's a full-time professional force. But there are many militaries around the world that are divided into professional and conscript arms. The Russian military being a case in point, just saying. And, well, it seems to me that both the IRGC and the conventional military in Iran are clearly subordinate and report to the same set of senior officials in the Iranian government, who of course include Speaker Ghalibaf and the current supreme leader of Iran, Mujtaba Khamenei. Now, on the question of decapitation strikes, at this point I should mention a superb article published on his Substack blog by Gordon Hahn, who we've been honoured to have as a guest on our show on the Duran. And Gordon Hahn has gone through and discussed in detail the whole decapitation strike strategy practiced both by Israel against its various adversaries in the Middle East and by Ukraine against Russia. And he has made the point that in both cases, the decapitation strategy has been a total failure. It has indeed succeeded in killing quite a lot of senior leaders and officials, but in no case has that led to any kind of political or military achievement. It has failed to do that against state actors like Russia and Iran, as we have seen. And it has ultimately not even succeeded against the far weaker parastate militias or terrorist organizations, if you prefer, like Hamas and Hezbollah, even though they have had their leaders killed. Nonetheless, they continue to function. And as we see, certainly in the case of Hezbollah, they continue to function as effectively as always. So the second plan, a further decapitation strike. Well, I don't really see what that's going to achieve, other than lose the United States even more sympathy around the world, make the situation in terms of negotiations with the Iranian leadership even more complex and even more difficult, and cause a further stiffening on the part of the leadership in Iran, which, if it has its worries about being assassinated by agents of the United States and Iran reinforced, is surely going to become even less willing to engage in negotiations. And anyway, the third proposal is the proposal which has been previously floated by the President of the United States, the attacks on power stations, on civilian infrastructure, on bridges, and all of those things. We are told that the US military are extremely unhappy about acting on this plan, given that doing so could involve them in war crimes. I've discussed all of this extensively. But I've also pointed out previously, when this idea was proposed, that I didn't see how it could succeed. I think it underestimates the scale and sophistication of Iran's civilian infrastructure spread out over this enormous country, or Iran's ability to repair it and to keep functioning despite whatever damage is done to it. And putting aside the very real, the very proper legal and moral concerns, there must be the further concern that if the United States starts to go down this road, well, the Iranians will respond with strikes against the civilian infrastructure of the Persian Gulf states, the energy facilities, the pumping stations, the pipelines, the terminals on the Red Sea, and that their friends, the Houthis, will join in, complicating and escalating the crisis even further. And of course, if there are attacks on the desalination plants, well, at that point, as I've said already, we're looking at a humanitarian catastrophe as well. So none of these plans, to me, look like they make any sort of sense. We are now getting reports about the extraordinary circumstance of the dismissal of the Secretary of the Navy, John Phelan. And the reports, including a lengthy article about this in the Daily Telegraph, say that the proximate cause for Phelan's sacking was Trump's deep frustration at the performance of the US Navy in the war. There'd been tensions between Phelan and Hegseth. Hegseth has tensions with pretty much everybody amongst the permanent staff and the political appointees at the Pentagon. Just saying. But, well, it seems that he was particularly angry with Phelan, because Phelan, who is a civilian with no background in naval or military affairs, anyway, that Phelan has been pushing back on some of the wilder ideas of deploying the US Navy closer to the Iranian coastline, where, of course, the Iranians would be in a better position to attack it. The president has shared this frustration. There's also been arguments about shipbuilding, which is admittedly a major problem for the Navy. And anyway, all of this boiled over, and following a meeting between Hegseth and Trump, the decision was made then and there to sack Phelan. Now, Phelan is apparently an old friend of Donald Trump. He has a residence in Florida, close to Trump's residence at Mar-a-Lago. He supported Trump in his political career, the twists and turns of his political career. He's provided funding for the president's campaigns. He was basically appointed by the president, Navy Secretary, as a reward for his loyalty up to now. In the American system, as anybody who knows the history of the United States, this is not so unusual. And, well, perhaps Phelan was not ideal for the job, but there's no word that he was failing in. At least I've not seen any word that he was failing in it significantly, or that he wasn't successfully working with the Navy leadership. Anyway, putting all that aside, it seems that Phelan himself was not informed of the fact that he'd been fired. He first learned about it from news reports. He then telephoned to find out whether these reports were true. He wasn't able to get a coherent answer. He then himself went to the White House and demanded admission, and eventually was brought before the president himself. It's not clear how the meeting went, but anyway, Phelan left the meeting, discovering that he had indeed been sacked by his old friend Donald Trump. How he feels about Trump now, I'm not going to waste time seeking to explore. But this whole bizarre episode coming atop on top of all the other sackings and dismissals that have been such a feature of the Hegseth War Department, sackings and dismissals that also started or rather resumed after the start of the conflict with Iran, like the sacking of General Randy George, the chief of staff of the army, and various other generals as well, on the 2nd of April. Well, all of this, again, points to dissension, argument, conflict within the administration between the president and his senior military officials, with the president increasingly frustrated and exasperated that what he has repeatedly called the mightiest, most powerful military on earth is unable quickly to win the war for him. And we see that people get sacked, and now the president's own friend, old friend John Phelan, has been sacked in this frankly shocking way. And, well, that isn't the end of it, because on top of that sacking, we have had perhaps the single most disturbing story highlighting the depth of the president's frustration of all. There were reports in, I think it was the Wall Street Journal, a short time ago, about how Donald Trump was excluded from the war room during the operation to, well, let's say the operation to rescue the navigator of the shot down F-15. As was pointed out over the course of a live stream we did on the Duran yesterday, with our guest being none other than the US attorney, Robert Barnes, as was pointed out over the course of that live stream by a member of the Duran community, there has, in fact, been no visible appearance of this navigator who was supposedly rescued. Maybe he's injured and he's in hospital, but it is a bit strange that his name, identity, so far as I know, well, has not been disclosed, and that the president and his officials have not produced him. One would, might have assumed that they would. Anyway, I don't want to make more about that. The key point here is the fact that the president, according to the Wall Street Journal, which I believe, by the way, was not allowed, or rather was asked to leave the room, the war room, even as the operation to, shall we say, rescue this navigator was underway, because the military people in the room basically said to the president that they couldn't continue with the operation whilst he was there, giving contradictory, absurd, nonsensical, dangerous orders. Well, that was already rings alarm bells. But there's now been perhaps the most extraordinary story of all, the one which again highlights the extent of the president's stress and frustration in this situation. Because Larry Johnson, the former US intelligence officer, the former very senior US intelligence officer, an individual who is extremely well informed and who, as I've come to learn, is very level-headed about these matters. Anyway, he is reporting on his blog, Sonar 21, that at some sort of war planning meeting attended by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Kane, the president became increasingly angry, began to lose his temper. There was an altercation between him and General Kane, and he demanded, the president demanded access to the access codes authorizing use of nuclear weapons. And General Kane, who, I have to say this, in my opinion, showed significant weakness before the war. At the meetings in February, before the war began, when he should have spoken out clearly against this operation, which he didn't apparently believe in, he failed to do so, which ultimately led, was one of the contributing factors to leading to the operation taking effect. Anyway, on this occasion, General Kane apparently told the president unequivocally that he would not have access, he would not be granted possession of the access codes, that the military was not prepared to give them to him because, well, clearly they were worried that he might do something irresponsible and reckless with them. Now, I find this story beyond disturbing. I've never heard anything like this happen in the modern history of the United States. A straightforward quarrel between the President of the United States and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff over something like this. But on that same live stream that we did yesterday with Robert Barnes, who has consistently shown himself to be an exceptionally well-informed person about what takes place in Washington. Anyway, Robert Barnes, I know not on what basis, but I have total reliance on his word here. Anyway, Robert Barnes said that he could definitely confirm that what Larry Johnson was reporting is true. So, well, the president is frustrated. He's very angry. Anybody who goes to his Truth Social account can see that. He's made extraordinary, gratuitous comments, insulting comments about China and India in a recent post, over the course of which he described both of these countries as hellholes, something which the Indian government, which has been bending over backwards to appease him over the last year, could not allow to pass by, and which caused them to push back and criticize him. Anyway, the president is clearly frustrated and very angry, and I suspect very stressed, and probably also at some level frightened, and he's behaving in this increasingly erratic way, sacking people like John Phelan, his old friend, even though there doesn't appear to be any specific reason why John Phelan should be sacked. There's been no reason given for the sacking. And, well, we've now had this report about the issue of the access codes for nuclear weapons. There is, by the way, something which does slightly puzzle me about this story, which some of you who follow this program might be able to clarify. I always assumed that the president actually had 24-hour access to the access codes. I thought there was a suitcase that was carried around by a Secret Service officer who was in constant attendance on the president, which presumably the president is in a position to call and use. I'm not quite sure, therefore, about the mechanics of this particular story. But then I don't pretend to know, thankfully, very much about how the truly awesome and terrifying decisions around use of nuclear weapons would be made in the United States. So again, I'm not going to explore this subject further. I'm not going to discuss something I don't actually know much about. I leave it to you, my viewers, to clarify the truth of this. Anyway, there we are. We are in effect a stalemate, an unstable equilibrium. As I discussed in my program yesterday, The Economist magazine in London that deals with business matters is saying that the last tankers from the Middle East carrying oil that were that exited the Persian Gulf before the start of the conflict have now reached their destinations in Europe, that from this point on the oil shortages are going to get much, much worse, and that we're going to see a sharply rising curve of crisis in the oil supply situation. And in the meantime, as I said, we remain in this unstable equilibrium, with the president becoming frightened and frustrated as he gradually comes to realize that he has no good military cards to play. Now, there continue to be hopes that some kind of diplomacy might now resume. There's reports today that the Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi is flying to Islamabad to meet with the Pakistani mediators. There's a flurry of hope out there that this trip by Araghchi to Pakistan might result in some sort of resumption of the diplomatic process. I have to say that what I am hearing about this meeting up to now may suggest otherwise. It seems that Araghchi is coming to Pakistan with only a small group of staffers. In other words, we're not looking at a full negotiating team or anything like that. To me, this looks more like a follow-up to the visit to Pakistan, or to the visit to Iran by the Pakistani Chief of Staff, Field Marshal Munir, which took place a couple of days ago, than a real indication of some sort of diplomatic breakthrough. My own view is that if there is going to be a diplomatic breakthrough, the United States needs first to scrap this ineffectual blockade that it has imposed on American port, on Iran. It's got to inform the Iranians that it accepts that Iran does have a sovereign right to conduct uranium enrichment at some level, the terms of which, however, need to be negotiated. I think the Iranians would probably agree to negotiate on that basis and might soften some of their demands, their other demands, if the Americans agreed to that. And I think that the US also needs to open a proper dialogue with those countries that do have genuine leverage over Iran, because in effect they are supporting Iran through this crisis, which are of course the Chinese and the Russians. And we have had very public demonstrations today, over the last 24 hours, from the Russians and the Iranians, that they are indeed supporting each other, and that in particular, Russia is providing military support to Iran. And again, this is not being reported widely, but in fact, there was yesterday a ceremony in Moscow. I believe this took place in the Iranian embassy, but it might have taken place somewhere else. It happened on the occasion of Iran's celebration of its military National Army Day. And the celebrations in Moscow were attended by a senior military officer, Major General Yevgeny Ilin, who is the first deputy head of the main directorate of international military cooperation at the Russian Ministry of Defense. And over the course of this celebration, of which there is a photograph of General Ilin speaking in the presence of Russian military officers, with Iranian officials in Moscow standing by, and in front of a picture of the recently assassinated supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Well, over the course of this celebration, General Ilin said the following: Iranian armed forces showed to the world a shining example of their firm resolve to defend their country's interests. And he then went on to say that the Iranian military stands ready to deliver a proper and proportionate response to emerging challenges and threats, and that the Islamic Republic of Iran and its armed forces had provided an example of steadfastness and courage in protecting their country's defense and security, and had as a result become a reliable guarantor of the Iranian nation's independence and stability. These are extraordinarily fulsome words. And General Ilin, who as deputy chief of the Russian Defense Ministry's International Affairs Department, it must be seen as a military diplomat, a diplomat in uniform. I'm not suggesting he's not also a proper soldier, but he is also somebody who, within the Defence Ministry, conducts diplomacy on behalf of the Russian military and indeed of Russia with other countries. Anyway, General Ilin, well, what we have seen is that in speaking in this fulsome way, it is inconceivable that he has acted without the authorization of the heads of the Russian Defense Ministry, Defense Minister Belousov and Chief of the General Staff Gerasimov. And they, in turn, Belousov especially, must be acting in accord with the general policy of the Russian leadership, headed, of course, by Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia. So I'm going to say something further. Obviously, this ceremony, because it commemorates the Iranian military, well, it is appropriate that a Russian general should participate in it rather than, say, a civilian official. But the amount of publicity that this event has been given, both in Iran and, by the way, in Russia, well, and the presence of such a senior Russian military officer, and the words about steadfastness, stability, the Iranian military being a shining example of firm resolve, and all of that. Well, again, I have to say that, to me, that is a further clear indication of collaboration of the Russian and Iranian militaries working together, of the Russians telling the Iranians, well, you're doing superb work. We've given you all this technology. We've given you all this know-how. We've given you all this intelligence. And you are using it effectively and well. That's how it looks to me. And I'm sure that is how it was understood, both in that room and in Iran, on the part of everybody who is fully in the know about this affair. I've noticed that the Chinese regularly deny that they're providing military assistance to Iran, direct military assistance in terms of weapons deliveries to Iran. I've noticed that the Russians avoid doing the same thing. They never make the categorical denials that the Chinese do. And I think you can treat the absence of these categorical denials and the statements of people like General Ilin as a clear sign that military assistance is indeed being provided by Russia to Iran and that it is indeed making a difference. Now, the Iranians, for their part, have responded, because on the same day that General Ilin was making these statements, the Iranian Foreign Ministry announced that the Russians have been permitted by the Iranians to transit through the Strait of Hormuz. So this is from the Iranian media now. Iran has granted exemptions to certain friendly countries, including Russia, from transit tolls imposed on vessels passing through the Strait of Hormuz. The Iranian ambassador to Moscow said, Iran's ambassador, Kazem Jalali, told RIA Novosti that Tehran is currently applying special provisions for friendly nations, allowing them to benefit from exceptions to newly introduced transit fees in the Strait of Hormuz. And Jalali did say that this is still a temporary measure. But then he went on to say that the foreign ministry is working to implement the exemptions as part of broader efforts to maintain cooperation with allied countries. Allied countries. And I'm taking those words from Iran's semi-official Tasnim news agency. We see here that Iran is referring to Russia as its ally. So allies, by definition, are countries that cooperate with each other on military matters. To me, we are now far beyond the point of reasonable doubt. The Russians and the Iranians are working together, and the Russians clearly are providing help. The Americans perhaps should recognize that fact and should realize that when they're taking on Iran, they're not taking on a country that is fighting on its own. It is a country that has a great power backer, namely Russia, behind it. Now, as to that, there's been much discussion about Russian intelligence assistance to Iran. Yesterday, the Russians launched another rocket from their Plesetsk Cosmodrome in the Arctic Circle, which apparently placed more satellites, surveillance satellites, in orbit. I'm not going to discuss this in any detail, save to say one thing, which is that ever since the collapse of the Soviet Union, Russia's space program has been racked by problems. There's been many failed launches, many failures in separation of rockets, so that satellites that were to be placed in orbit have not done so. The new cosmodrome at Vostochny that was being built in eastern Siberia was running up enormous costs and had many overruns, with the whole project racked by what looked to be entirely true corruption allegations. But I've noticed that over the last 2 years, but perhaps especially in the last few months, all of those problems have been resolved. The Russians are now launching space rockets carrying satellites, mostly for the military, but also sometimes for civilian applications, at very frequent, very regular intervals. Not perhaps quite as often as was the case of the Soviet Union, under the Soviet Union, but there seems to be a steady, even steeply rising curve. And these are using all the new rockets, the Angara rockets, for example. And where we previously had regular failed launches, all the recent launches have been faultless. It looks as if the Russians have got over the problems in their space program, finally, after a massive effort, that it's now once again a functioning and effective program once more. And, well, it's having its effect in these increasingly dense satellite arrays that the Russians are now placing in orbit. The satellites that make up Russia's rival to the American Starlink system being one example. And I believe these are now actually in operation. Perhaps in time or in conjunction with the ongoing Russian offensive in Ukraine. But we see that the Russian Defense Ministry is now also very busy rebuilding its satellite surveillance capabilities, which in the era of the Soviet Union were probably at one time the most comprehensive in the world. Just saying. Anyway, in the meantime, even as that is happening, of course, the war in Ukraine goes on. And, well, there's been some further developments here. I've discussed in recent programs the developments in Kupiansk, the fact that after all the talk about the successful Ukrainian counterattack in Kupiansk, Ukraine's complete recapture of the city of Kupiansk, we were seeing now pictures of Russian soldiers all over the city of Kupiansk on the west bank of the Oskol River. There's also been lots of reports, including from General Gerasimov, the Russian commander, that the Ukrainians have been driven back from the or defeated on the east bank of the Oskol River. There's still some uncertainty as to the exact position of the various forces, just saying. But that things have gone badly wrong for the Ukrainians in the Kupiansk sector is confirmed by announcements that the Ukrainian leadership, Zelensky and Sirsky, appear to be sacking all of the Ukrainian commanders who were directly involved in the fighting in Kupiansk. This does not so far extend to General Drapaty, who I understand is the overall commander of Ukrainian troops in the Kupiansk area. But General Drapaty is very well connected politically, so there might be some concerns about sacking him. But several subordinate commanders have also been sacked, In any event, it does now seem as if the battle of Kupiansk is now indeed conclusively and irrefutably ended. The Russians control in Kupiansk both the east and the west bank, the area where the Ukrainian troops had been encircled or allegedly encircled by the Russians, that is now under Russian control. The Russians control Kupiansk, Kuzlovoy, to the south of Kupiansk, other settlements and communities on the east bank of the Oskol. The Russians are in full control. And I cannot see now any scenario in which the Ukrainians are going to be able to return. And, well, there are now also reports that the Russians are building up. Well, these are reports of the Ukrainians, that the Russians are sending large numbers of reinforcements into Konstantinovka. I said that recent programs that it seemed to me as if the main urban area of Konstantinovka, the high-rise buildings and the factory sector, has been captured by the Russians. It looks to me as if the Russians are now preparing for the last big storming operation of Konstantinovka, and that this is what explains this additional deployment of forces to the city. And further north, there's been reports that the Russians have entered the village of Raya Alexandrovka, which brings them closer to Kramatorsk and puts them on hill where they can attack the supply routes into and out of Kramatorsk. There are reports that the Russians are pushing towards a village immediately to the east of Kramatorsk called Malinovka, which is seen as Kramatorsk's, part of Kramatorsk's inner defensive line before the town itself, the city itself, is reached. But perhaps the most dramatic news is coming from Zaporozhye region, where, according to the Ukrainians, the Russians have now concentrated a force of five out of their seven airborne divisions under the command of General Teplinsky as part of a group of forces Dnieper. Group of forces Dnieper is the force that is in charge of the defense of eastern Kherson region and also Zaporozhye region, the Zaporozhye region under Russian control, which includes the east bank of the Dnieper and which has positions immediately to the south of the city of Zaporozhye itself. Now, five airborne divisions is a very powerful force. I noticed that one of these divisions is the 98th Guards Division, which was, for the record, the division which eventually captured Chasiv Yar last year. It's apparently rested and refitted since then, but has now been redeployed to this sector, to the Dnieper. And, of course, it's worth pointing out that the commander of group of forces, Dnieper, General Teplinsky, is himself a paratrooper, former paratrooper, and is the overall commander of Russia's airborne forces. So if this report is true, the Russians are now concentrating their paratroopers, perhaps their most elite infantry, alongside the Marines, their Marines, in one sector of the battlefronts, under the command of their own direct commander, who is General Teplinsky. And there's much speculation about what this is all about, whether it is intended for some cross-river operation to capture the city of Kherson, or whether it's intended to capture Orekhov, which is located to the east of General Teplinsky's forces, or whether it's intended for some sort of big battle to capture the city of Zaporozhye itself. This paratroop force is said to number somewhere in the region of 40,000 men, by the way. Now, I have no doubt at all that the target is the city of Zaporozhye. There are also reports that the Russians are now in the process of breaking through the defences to the east of Orekhov. The Russian forces that have been advancing westwards from Velikaya Novosilka, and which at the end of last year captured the town of Gulyapolye, have now resumed their offensive. They're capturing various fortified villages in this area. They're in the process of capturing one such village, which confusingly is called Gulyapolske. And all of that is bringing them very close to Orekhov itself. I'm going to guess that it is this force which is being charged with the capture of Orekhov. Ultimately, these two forces, the one commanded by General Teplinsky, which has been advancing on Zaporozhye from the south, and the one that's been pushing towards Orekhov and Zaporozhye from the east. These two forces are going to join up together, and, well, presumably, we're going to see a major operation against the city of Zaporozhye start to play out this year. This is going to be an extraordinary battle. In the meantime, of course, as this commentary already says, the Russian offensive continues on every sector now of the front lines. I've been following developments on the ground very closely over the last 10 days or so, since the Russian offensive got underway. My sense is that it is moving significantly faster than it was doing at this time last year. I get the sense that there are many more gaps in the Ukrainian front lines, that the Ukrainian army is much more run down than it was last year, that there's less infantry, even the Ukrainians admit this, and that this is enabling the Russians to push forward further and faster than they were doing last year, despite all that we've heard about the Ukrainian drones. I am not sure whether any of this is understood in Europe. Apparently, all of the European leaders, after they approved the 90 billion euro loan, which I discussed in my program yesterday, the 90 billion euro loan to Ukraine. Anyway, they all then went with Zelensky himself to a resort in Cyprus. And, well, I've heard, in part from my friend Alex Christoforou and other places, that they were all celebrating and partying rather intensely, because, well, they finally got this 90 billion euro loan paid to Ukraine, though it's important to stress Ukraine only gets 30 billion out of this 90 billion. And, well, they're again talking bravely about accelerating. Ursula is talking bravely about accelerating Ukraine's entry into the EU, apparently oblivious to the fact that the Russians are giving every sign of now reversing their position and coming out and opposing it. Just saying. So I wonder to what extent Ursula and the others, Kallas and all of the others, really understand now what is actually taking place on the front lines. This is the problem when you spread stories about how successful you've been in mounting counteroffensives in Kupiansk and Zaporozhye region, which is what the Ukrainians have been doing, that you don't prepare your own people or your sponsors in the West for bad news. Well, the bad news is going to come. It's going to come in economic terms, now that there is no longer a regular supply of oil and LNG from the Persian Gulf. The Russians, as I said, closed the pipeline from Kazakhstan, and they are on the advance in Ukraine. And I read a report yesterday that, according to more realistic estimates, more realistic estimates, there's been a visible contraction in the Ukrainian economy over the last 3 months. Ukraine, well, I suspect, is not just in economic contraction. I think it's in free fall, just saying. Anyway, there we go. Now, that then brings me to the last topic of this program, which is the situation in the Russian economy. Today, the Russian Central Bank cut interest rates by a further 50 base points from 15% to 14.5%. This compares with the 12%, which is what the Russian steel conglomerate Severstal and the economics ministry thinks is the proper interest rate at this period. The central bank, Nabiullina, its chair, have however come out fighting, and Nabiullina has published a number of statements about the state of the economy. She downplays the contraction that took place in January and February. She says that conditions in the economy have settled in March and April. She believes that there will be growth in the economy overall this year. And more importantly, she expects the real level of inflation to reach 4% by mid-year, by the second half of this year, so that inflation will once again be on target, according to the central bank's target, by the second half of this year. She also says that the overall situation in the financial sector, in the economy as a whole, is stable. That is what Nabiullina says. Well, as I said, I still think that many people, myself included, feel that her rate-cutting strategy errs very much on the cautious side. But perhaps at this point, it's worth pointing out what another Russian official, a critic of Nabiullina, the economics minister, Maxim Reshetnikov, how he describes the overall situation in the economy in Russia. He says at a meeting of a Serb-Russian business forum in Belgrade yesterday the following: despite challenges and attempts to exclude us from global processes, our economy remains stable, open and competitive. It retains its market-based character. Yes, last year our GDP growth was 1%. This was due to deliberate steps. This is the price, first and foremost, for reducing inflation, and this goal has largely been achieved. On a 3-year period, 2023 to 2025, the economy grew by more than 10% in real terms, and the main driver is domestic demand, both consumer and investment. At the end of last year, inflation was 5.6% at an annualized rate. And as we see from the dynamics for this year, the slowdown in inflation is an absolutely stable trend. At the same time, unemployment remains at a low level, 2.1% in February. We see that we have strong foundations for further development. And then Rostat, the Russian statistical agency, has provided inflation data. And it says that for the first 20 days of April, inflation stood at 5.68%, as compared with 5.77% earlier in April, 5.86% at the end of March, and the indications point, as I've said, to a continued fall, with the Russian Central Bank predicting that the 4% target will be achieved in the second half of this year. I believe that these numbers are correct. I think all those reports that you see about a crisis in the economy, about the economy running out of money, are certainly wrong. I think we will see both inflation and interest rates fall, and I believe that we will indeed see, as Reshetnikov is saying, a return to growth in the second half of 2026. At that point, I predict that the narrative in the West will move to something else, even as the West's own economies fall into deeper crisis. They will come up with some explanation, both for Russian resilience, presumably high oil prices, and they will say that somehow, in some form or other, what we see, what is visibly true about the stability of the Russian economy, is not really the truth. And at that point, I will have to do that which I have been doing basically for the last 15, 20 years, which is saying that yes, what we see is true, really is true. But anyway, that's for the future. This is where we are today. I'm going to finish this program at this point. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X, and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar by going to our shop, and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.